Welcome to the Endless Knot Podcast,
where the more we know,
the more we want to find out,
tracing serendipitous connections through our lives
and across disciplines.
Hi, I'm Avon.
And I'm Mark.
And today, we're going to be talking about condiments. Getting a little saucy? Sorry, that was horrible. See, I apologize.
I was going to make a much worse joke. Condiments are not, you know, something left on your pillow in your condo, but...
Oh, that's really bad. It's not even dirty or funny or anything. Right. So maybe I would say that we're trying to get all the pens out of our system early, but I bet that's not true. I bet we'll find some more. But anyway, yes, we're going to talk about condiments. This is just something that's kind of occurred to us recently, a bunch of words and historical details that we thought were interesting. So just really a word-focused episode, I think, today.
And history.
And history. And food, because you may have gathered we're kind of into food. We don't have any major follow-up or business to do before we get started, other than I wanted to mention that I was very pleased that after our last episode on Gimlet and gin, at least two people contacted me to say that they had been inspired to go out and buy some gin or try some gin again after having not liked it before. I'm so glad to lead you down an evil primrose path.
Excellent.
So well done, everyone. And that brings us to cocktails for tonight. So tonight we're having Caesars, Bloody Caesars.
Indeed. Which is, if you're not from Canada, a bit like a Bloody Mary, except instead of using tomato juice, you make it with tomato juice with clam juice added, or more likely, you make it with Clamato.
Which is a particular brand, which is tomato juice with clam juice added. Or other things calling themselves Caesar Mix. There's now various other fancy or other brands that call themselves Caesar Mix. But to me, it's a Bloody Caesar is Clamato.
Yeah.
It's a particular brand with vodka.
And we'd be interested to hear if you are indeed from outside of Canada, if you've ever heard of this cocktail before and if it has made its way into the global cocktail world.
Like a Bloody Mary, it also is usually served with various condiments. And that's part of the reason we chose it. The seafood connection will become evident, I think, why that's relevant. It's also a Bloody Caesar, which of course is Roman, and I'm going to be talking a fair amount about some Roman condiments, and I've garnished it today with some bitters, the Scrappy's Firewater bitters, which are essentially like Tabasco sauce without the vinegar, and Worcester sauce, which is a key component, like for a Bloody Mary, it's a key component of a Caesar. And then instead of the traditional celery, I've used one of our homemade pickled asparagus spears. This is partly because I just think they're yummy and will be less crunchy for you listening. But also as a nod to another little Roman bit, because not that asparagus are specifically Roman, but I always think of them as being Roman because they were eaten, certainly by Romans, and they liked them. And Augustus, Emperor Augustus, one of his favorite sayings was, "Do something as quick as boiled asparagus." It was just one of his homely sayings that he would use. So I always think of asparagus as being Roman. And there's your Caesar connection.
Right. Okay, good.
So cheers.
Cheers.
Oh, I do like a Caesar. Clamato is really good. I know that if you haven't heard of it before, you're sitting there right now thinking, tomato and clam juice? Are you people out of your minds? That can't possibly be good. All I can say to you is it's delicious.
Well, and apparently the drink's creator invented the drink out of inspiration of Italian cuisine mixing clams and tomato.
Right, of course. That's a classic.
Clams and tomato on pasta.
That's a classic dish.
That's true. A classic dish. And so he basically turned it into a cocktail.
Oh, well, that makes it sound very classy. Oh, and the other reason we're having it is I had suggested it because we got a bottle of Clamato for the May 2-4 weekend here, Victoria Day weekend, which is another holiday that nobody outside of Canada knows about. And I'd be hard put to explain why we even have a holiday celebrating Queen Victoria, but we do. And it's the traditional beginning of summer in Canada. It's the weekend everybody opens their cottages and goes to the beach for the first time, even though it's rarely warm enough. And it's also the last frost date. So gardeners start their gardening in a lot of Canada, not everywhere. So it's sort of the traditional beginning of summer. So I suggested we could make this drink today since we had it. And then I happened to see a sponsored tweet, I'm sorry to say that I actually saw one, saying that today is National Caesar Day. I don't think anyone except Mott's Clamato believes that today is National Caesar Day. But anyway, that being the Thursday before the May 2-4 weekend, which is, as they say, the traditional beginning of the summer. That just seemed to clinch it. It's yes. National Caesar Day. I guess we have to have a Caesar.
Indeed. And we will be coming back to Worcestershire sauce. Bleh. And we will be coming back to Worcestershire sauce.
If you just
you pronounce the sure.
If you just cut everything else out, though, it's so much easier to pronounce. If you just start with the first syllable and the last syllable and just cut the stuff in the between. That's my approach. So, we can talk about Worcestershire sauce. Yeah, that'll be actually relevant.
Particularly relevant, yes.
So good. All right. Well, then, without further ado, let us turn to this subject of condiments. And it really was a slightly random topic. Somebody suggested it to
us. Someone suggested ketchup.
Right.
Yeah, it was at least via Sam. He maybe passed.
Somebody else asked about ketchup. Yeah, Sam McLean, I think, asked about it or passed on the idea that we should talk about ketchup. That's right. That's why we put it on a list. So thank you, Sam. And that kind of led us to thinking more broadly about condiments and sauces because they are actually interesting. There's interesting stories to do with some of the names. And also sauces end up being quite emblematic of the cultures that produce them. Or at least some sauces are. And so we thought that could give us a topic to talk about.
Indeed. And I think we're going to have a sort of couple of running themes that go through this discussion of sauces and condiments and so forth about stored foods, processed foods, and globalized foods.
Right. So do you want to just start off with the word sauce?
Well, we should start off with the word condiment.
Right. Okay.
Perhaps. Which essentially means stored, preserved. Right. Literally, it means put together.
Mm-hmm.
So con, cum, and an Indo-European root that gives us a whole bunch of words. It's a highly productive root that means to put.
Okay.
So it's from the idea of sort of putting away, I guess, is the idea.
Mm-hmm.
But it's preserved, pickled food.
And it comes from Latin.
Comes from Latin. Yeah. Via French, of course. So condiments are essentially preserves. They're preserved sauces that preserved foodstuffs. The sort of related concept to condiments is, of course, seasoning, because condiments and seasoning are both used for flavoring foods.
Mm-hmm.
Seasoning linguistically means it's related to seasons, the time of year, from the notion of ripened fruit. So if you allow fruit to ripen, it becomes better.
Right.
So if you add a seasoning, it improves the
possibly food. Subpar food or brings things up to its sort of perfection or better quality. Okay.
Now, what's the difference between seasonings and condiments?
In, say, modern use?
In say, modern use, one might ask. Yeah. And so we can turn to Auguste Escoffier, who is the codifier of Western cuisine, I guess you could...
French cuisine.
European cuisine. He's the guy who codified the idea of the five mother sauces.
Right, right.
And according to Wikipedia, he also specifically codified the difference between seasonings and condiments.
Mm-hmm.
And he comes up with sort of these categories. So you have saline seasonings, salt-based seasonings, acid seasonings, so vinegar-based seasonings.
Or lemon juice, yeah.
Or lemon juice.
Mm-hmm.
Hot seasonings, so things like peppercorns or other hot spices. And saccharin seasonings, so sugar, honey.
Right.
And then condiments include the pungents, so onions, shallots, garlics, chives, that sort of thing, horseradish. Hot condiments, so mustard, most importantly, and what we would consider various types of pickled things, gherkins, capers.
Those count as hot?
Hot, yeah.
Hmm, interesting.
Including Worcestershire sauce.
Okay.
And other similar type sauces. And then fatty substances, so butter, oils, and so forth.
Okay. I don't think of the fatty ones anyway as being condiments, at least in my... But then, you know, who am I to quibble with to quibble with Escoffier, okay?
But obviously, you know, the idea of salt plays into kind of, in a sense, both of these categories.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, salt is a seasoning in itself,
just
on its own.
And certainly in modern cooking, when they say season,
they usually mean add salt
and pepper.
Yeah. But in terms of those various types of pickled condiments, obviously salt plays an important role in the production of those products.
As I was saying before we started, for me, not having heard that definition before, I would have said that I couldn't think of a single condiment that I would call a condiment that didn't have salt in it.
Right.
When I think of condiments now, I think of them as being highly flavored, sort of concentrated flavored things that you add to food at the table, pretty much. At the end, that it's, you don't cook with it, it gets added at the end. That's to me what a condiment is. So that's ketchup. I mean, you might use it in cooking as well, but the reason it's a condiment is it's because it's something you might add at the end. So mustard, ketchup, relish are the really basic ones, but a bunch of other Worcester sauce or HP sauce or all sorts of other things like that. Kimchi, I mean, all of those things are things you'd add at the end. Mm-hmm. And every single one of them has salt, and most of them are highly salted.
Right.
And then all sorts of chutneys and curried pickles and things like that would all count as condiments to me. And all of those are, because everything that's pickled, almost everything that's pickled has salt in it as well.
So, of course, you know, as we said, salt has this important role in preserving in probably cultures around the world independently.
Figure that one out.
That salt could be used to preserve foods. And so this goes way back in terms of human history. It's also, though, when you think about it, one of the first sorts of processed foods, because the method of getting salt, you have to either mine it or evaporate water from you know, seawater to get the salt out. So it's one of the first processed foods.
Even if it's a fairly basic processing,
Even if
salt
it's
pans
basic.
And things like that are early forms of processing.
And so salt becomes necessary as soon as you get agriculture.
Right.
When you're a hunter-gatherer, you get your basic salt requirements. I mean, it's an important nutrient that the body needs.
But it's in, if you're eating a lot of meat.
If you're eating a lot of meat, you're getting enough salt. But as soon as a large part of your basic diet is taken up with grains, you need to supplement that with salt. And so it also is the sort of foundation of processed food.
Right.
Sauce, the word sauce, is related to salt.
I was just going to bring that up if you didn't. I was waiting for you to, because I figured you would.
So they all come from this same, you know, Latin root. I mean, the word salt, in fact, comes through the English, through the Germanic line, but it comes from the same Proto-Indo-European root.
So in Latin, it's sal, salis.
Sal, salis, from which salsa or salsum, salsus,
meaning
the
adjective salted.
Which also gives us, of course, the word salsa, which is a kind of sauce. Think about it, it's not very surprising. But it also gives us the word sauce, importantly. Sausage, which is salted meat. Basically, it's a particular kind of sausage, which has then become known as all the sausages. So salted meat, salted sausages.
So basically, at least from the sausage making we've done, that's actually a really key element that I didn't realize until we started making sausages at home, which we did a little bit of last year and the year before. I didn't realize that adding salt to the meat in a certain very specific proportion, which actually produces a chemical reaction with the proteins, was really key to making sausages. I mean, I knew sausages had salt in them, but like so does everything else. I didn't, but apparently it's actually a really important part of what gives sausages their texture and helps them be preserved and things like that. So that wouldn't have surprised me to learn about the ones that are dried and cured, but even, you know, Italian sausages that you just are about to barbecue or whatever.
Right.
So that was something I didn't know, but that makes sense.
Indeed. And of course, the specific type of sausage, salami, also comes from that root.
Right. Right. Of course.
And by the by, salad.
Yep.
Basically means salted. It comes from the phrase herba salata, so salted vegetables.
Greens.
Which is a sort of late Latin medieval usage. Right. But the way that Romans presumably ate their vegetables as well, salted and seasoned. And slaw, as in coleslaw.
Also from that, right.
Also from that same root.
Salted cabbage.
Salted cabbage, yeah. So cool meaning cabbage. Related to kale, so literally salted cabbage. And just as a sort of by the by, so I should say kind of at the outset that a lot of what I'm going to say today is based on a book by Dan Jurafsky, which I highly recommend. It's an excellent book. A Linguist Reads the Menu, I think it's called. We'll put a link to it. But one of the things he points out, interestingly, he sort of talks about various different, the history of food and the words that are used to describe them. And he points out when he's talking about sauce and salsas, in particular salsa verde, that this is one of the few foods, a few recipes that makes its way from Europeans to the Muslim world.
Oh, interesting.
There's a lot of foods that come
go
in.
Go the other way.
Go the other way that, you know, during the crusading years that get picked up by Europeans and brought back home to Europe. But this is one of the few foods that kind
actually
of migrated
the other way.
And so I thought that was kind of an interesting.
Salsa verde being herbs.
Herbs.
And vinegar and salt, right?
Yeah.
And basically it's a sort of almost like a pesto, but with, vinegar instead of with oil.
Yeah. So, this sort of brings me to the Middle Ages. So the sauces in the Middle Ages were highly influenced by the notion of humorism. And so
the medical notion of humorism,
this idea that people have these four humors in their body, these four fluids. This is, of course, I should say, entirely outmoded medical.
Yes, medical theory.
Theory.
But it comes to them from the classical world.
From Galen, in particular.
Yeah, it's a long
history. Stretching back to Hippocrates in the Greek world. But there is this idea that the sauce that you pick has to be chosen from the standpoint of knowledge of the humors.
Right. So, and so the sauces, there's a sort of quadrant view of how all food is either hot or cold or dry or moist, or some combination of those. So you need to eat hot, moist food if you are particularly dry and cold yourself or whatever combination.
And similarly, you have to complement the So if a particular meat is hot and dry, you have to complement that with the right kind of sauce.
With a cool and moist sauce or whatever.
Yeah. And depending on the season, the time of year you use. In the winter, you use hot, dry.
To balance out the wintry cold.
So depending on the type of year and the person who's eating and the type of food that the sauce is going with, you choose your sauce very carefully.
So it's not about flavor. Compliment.
No,
it's more about medical. Right.
Yeah.
I think sometimes people now think they've invented, or maybe, to be fair, a lot of people feel that they've rediscovered, but the idea of thinking of all food as medicine.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's a very, very prevalent ancient and medieval thought that all food is medicine. And then, in fact, most medicine is just food. I was reading something, we'll get to it later, but about how the thing about ancient medicine is it's very non-interventionist because basically they didn't have a lot of interventions they could do that would really help. Didn't have a lot of actual medications. Surgery was
a last resort.
Really likely to kill you, basically. Yeah. Not because they couldn't do surgery, but mostly because you just get an infection and die.
Yeah.
And so they really didn't do surgery, except in a very few limited cases. And so they didn't really have a lot of interventions they could do. So diet was the major thing you could do.
Yeah.
Other than, you know, basic binding of wounds and stuff like that, but for illnesses. So that's what medicine was food. And therefore food was medicine.
Mm-hmm.
So that makes sense of the sauces.
And I will point out, this is a bit of a cheat, I suppose, but the word apothecary is from that same root. It's a very parallel kind of formation to condiment in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
But an apothecary was originally a storehouse. So it's the idea of to put away.
Oh, wait.
Again, storage.
From a Greek root, yeah.
From a Greek root, from the Greek side. So it's a sort of parallel to the Latin condiment in a way. But of course, we can't talk about sauces and seasonings in the Middle Ages without bringing up the very widely repeated notion that spices and sauces were used to cover either tainted or salt-preserved meats.
Mm-hmm. Tainted in the sense of gone bad.
Gone bad, yeah. So off, you know. Mm-hmm.
Stored too long, gone bad.
Rotting meat. So this is, you know, one of these myths that is sort of widely repeated, and you will see it splashed over the internet and so forth. The reality is that there are lots of reasons for using spices, and a lot of it comes down to the sort of display of wealth notion.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, spices are so expensive that you wouldn't throw it away on poor ingredients.
Right. The idea that you would have bad meat and then put spices that are almost literally worth their weight in gold onto the poor meat. If you could afford the spices, you could afford good meat.
Mm-hmm.
And if you couldn't and you had rotten meat, you also couldn't possibly afford the spices.
Yeah.
So there may well have been people who were eating bad meat, but they didn't get to disguise it. They just had to eat bad meat.
So myth quashed.
One of the reasons that comes up is because when you look at medieval recipes, they do tend to be, the ones that we have, very spice heavy. A lot more spicing and a lot stronger spicing than we would consider normal for such a dish. And so that was the idea that, oh, that's because they're trying to drown out the flavor. So the important thing, as you say, is the reason they're using so much spice
is it's conspicuous
consumption.
Consumption, yeah.
Very literally. Yeah. Consuming it conspicuously. Yeah. It's a way of showing off your wealth.
Yeah.
And what's important there is to remember that the recipes that we have that are written down from the Middle Ages until the late Middle Ages, really into the early modern period,
are feast recipes.
Yeah. They don't write down how normal people ate, even how rich people ate on normal days.
Yeah.
Because, and that's the same as we have for the ancient world, we do not have recipes for everyday Roman cooking. We only have recipes for the absolute gourmands and the gourmets and the show-off cookery. That's the only thing that was ever, that somebody, some man with the access to. Now, that's not quite true for the Middle Ages. There were women who would write things down. But still, basically, you're not going to spend expensive parchment and ink and scribal time
writing down basic
what peasants eat. Yeah. Like, it's just ludicrous. So you just wouldn't do it. So when we look at those recipes, we're looking at the equivalent of our Christmas feasts and Thanksgiving meals or something like that, not the equivalent of anything regular.
The other thing is that, you know, most of those recipes don't make clear quantities.
Right.
So
it's all a bit of guesswork.
It's all a bit of guesswork. People have sort of worked things out by looking at how much spices were purchased and working.
Because we do have, for the Middle Ages, not for the ancient world, but for the Middle Ages, you have inventory lists and things like that.
Yeah. But in any case, from what we can tell, they were used sparingly, you know, given their expense. Now, let's turn to a few condiments in particular and consider where they come from or where their names come from. Mustard is a medieval, particularly popular medieval sauce condiment, and it comes from must. So for anyone who knows anything about wine making.
Oh, right, right.
Must, as in the unfermented juice of the grapes.
Right.
Before you add the
yeast
or whatever to ferment it. And that was used in the preparation of the mustard seeds.
Right. So you'd grind the mustard seeds and add grape juice.
You'd add the grape juice, basically, to make your prepared mustard.
That's also referred to in the recipes we have, often referred to as verjuice, right? Which is, verjuice is that green grapes, like unripe grapes, because it's particularly sour?
Probably, though that's one of the things that plays into this humorism.
Okay,
So you would use vinegar in certain seasons or verjuice. So it depends what season you're in.
How acidic
you want it to be according to your medical requirements.
Right.
Relish literally means release. In fact, release is a cognate with relish.
Okay.
The idea is it's the flavor left behind that's released by the food. And so initially it's used to refer to just flavors, taste. It appears in English in the 1520s.
Right, like so the idea of the relish.
You relish something.
Yeah. Taste it.
It doesn't come to be used to refer to a specific type of sauce, a particular type of condiment, until the first occurrence is in 1797.
That's quite late.
So quite late, But of course, the most famous condiment of all, I suppose, is ketchup, which essentially is originally a Chinese fish sauce.
Right.
But of course, many cultures around the world have used fish sauce. This is not unique to China. And so there is a Western equivalent to this.
Right. This is my segue.
This is your segue.
Right. So that brings us to the famous sauce of antiquity. There are, of course, other sauces, but the one that it's best known, in particular for the Roman world, is garum. Now, garum is Roman fish sauce. There's a couple other words I'll get to in a moment. It's most strongly associated with the Roman world, but in fact, the Greeks ate it too.
Yeah.
They ate it first. And
it's called garos, I think, in
Greek. The word garum seems to come from the Greek garos, which seems to refer to a type of fish.
Ah, okay.
So probably then referred to the sauce as well. The other words that are associated with garum are liquamen and alec. So basically what garum is it's a fermented fish sauce. Mm-hmm. You make it by layering fish and salt and sometimes herbs in a jar or a container. And you let it stand for a couple of months, usually in the sun, till it ferments, stirring it occasionally. And the liquid then, a certain amount of liquefaction occurs as it ferments. And the liquid that comes off the top is called garum or liquamen. And the residue, the sort of solid part, is alec. And all of those things are condiments, very basic condiments in Roman cuisine. Now, once it was made, you could take that garum or liquamen and you could add herbs to it. And in fact, we have, it seems to have been something where there was many different brands in the ancient world. So we know that they were making in Greece, but it's just one of many things that people sometimes ate. But once you get to the Roman world, it's everywhere. It's much more foundational to Roman cuisine than it is to Greek cuisine, which is why it's more strongly associated with the Romans.
It's like the bottle of ketchup on the table of every
American
restaurant or whatever.
Yeah, diner.
Diner or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. And we can tell this because of a number of reasons, but one of them is there's lots of archaeological evidence of large factories, garum factories. Factories, of course, doesn't mean quite the same thing it means now, but, you know, big places where this was made in bulk. And there are specific regions around, it's all over the Mediterranean, but in particular, the shores of Spain and North Africa, there's a large concentration of it in the Black Sea. Often it has to do with the fisheries that are nearby, but there are particular regions that were well known for it. And it was made in bulk in these factories, and then it was shipped around the Mediterranean, and there was a whole industry of people who would be garum sellers. A lot of family monopolies, so in different regions, different sort of hereditary monopolies over the garum trade. And families or garum traders would get the stuff in bulk, and then they would add their own herbs or other flavorings to it, and so there'd be sort of house brands, house mixtures that were particular flavorings. You could add herbs. You could also add wine or vinegar or oil or water or honey and various other things to it. Hmm. And there were different words for that. So like oxyporum was one where you'd add honey and other spices to it. Hydrogarum is when you mix it with water. Oleogarum is when you mix it with oil. Oxygarum is when you mix it with vinegar. And oinogarum is when you mix it with wine. All of those are just garum with a word in front that means...
Yeah, now I'm thinking of the etymologies of all those words.
Well, oinos, of course. So a lot of those are interestingly Greek.
Greek, yeah.
Yeah, because these are Greek words, right? Garos is a Greek word. Oinos is Greek. Oxu is sharp in Greek.
Right.
Olia is oil in Greek. We've talked about that before in hydro.
Hydro.
Hujo is water, The oxyporum is this vinegar and honey added. That's a different mixture.
Right, okay.
It's a more complicated mixture. That one is very similar in a way to something like Worcester sauce because it has a mixture of fish sauce and honey and herbs and, you know, a number of different flavorings in it that produce this sauce. So you'd get these garum vendors mixing it their house brand and selling it in small containers. And then some of the different places were known for different kinds. So New Carthage on the east coast of Spain was known for some of the best garum, the highest quality that was made from mackerel that was most expensive. And as I said, there were like family monopolies and equestrian families, like quite high up families who ran these trading businesses. We have amphorae. It was shipped around the Mediterranean. One of the things that was good about it was that it could be shipped in the same sort of containers that wine was shipped in, these big pottery amphorae. Mm-hmm. And we have them with advertising on them. Like, so they'll say they're garum, but they'll have descriptive phrases like flower of garum or highest quality garum or, you know, so sort of descriptive and sometimes even kind of images that seem to be promoting a particular brand.
So this is our earliest example of advertising?
I don't know if it's our earliest. I don't know if it's our earliest. There may be others, but it is certainly an early example of sort of branding. And advertising.
I'm going to think about that if I can think of an earlier.
I'd have to look. I don't know if you know, there were Egyptian examples or Mesopotamian examples. There may well be. You know, those are pretty highly developed civilizations too. But one of the things that's going on here is because of the shipping across
wide
regions.
You don't know where it comes from.
Mm-hmm. Well, and because it's a very widespread thing, but it does differ where it comes from. It's not going to be the same. You know, at the same period, the Romans were also drinking wine that was very strongly branded.
Right.
Right. And But, you know, wine was sealed and it was labeled with its vineyards and its provenance and its and its year and all of those things. So Garum, you know, was part of that same sophisticated market, let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. By volume, Pliny says that Garum was about as expensive as perfume. That's a little hard to verify, and that some skepticism has been expressed by various classicists. I think what is true is it seems to have ranged. There was like really expensive garum and there was really cheap garum, and it depended where it came from and what kind it was and what it was made from and a bunch of things. There clearly was garum that was cheap enough for everybody to use. Lots and lots of containers that are marked as being garum and that you can do DNA testing and tell that it had fish residue in and stuff have been found all over the place. Everybody seems to have eaten it. Liquamen was the term used sometimes just generally for fish sauce, but also in some of our sources for the higher, the sort of more refined, higher class fish sauce. So Apicius, who is our best source for Roman recipes, only ever talks about liquamen. He doesn't talk about garum. And it seems to be that, you know, he's only talking about the best quality stuff, so he doesn't talk about garum. So there was like stuff that really fancy people could use, but there was also stuff that everybody was using. In that way, it's not quite the same as ketchup, because there's no fancy ketchup, except in the Bare Naked Ladies song. All the fanciest ketchups, Dijon custom ketchup. That's an If I Had $1 Million reference for those of you not up on your obscure Canadiana. So, you know, it does. So it's a little more maybe like mustard,
right?
Where there's basic yellow mustard that everybody has, but there's fancy mustards you could have that French chefs might use. We really are talking about a processed food. It was a byproduct in some ways of salting fish in general. The Romans ate lots of salted fish. It was not a high class food in general, but it was necessary. Before refrigeration, you cannot eat fish if you live more than a couple of miles from the sea.
Right.
Before refrigeration and fast transport, unless you salt it.
Yeah.
And salt fish was a big industry as well. And this is sort of a byproduct of it that develops into its own industry. Just to call back to what you were talking about with humors, and the other thing about garum is it does turn up as a medicine, just like any food really does. So Galen, who you already mentioned, prescribes it for a number of internal complaints and external. It gets used as in a poultice, suggested as something to treat burns. You should put garum on, which, given how salty it would be, sounds excruciating.
But imagine, it might actually...
It might work as an antiseptic. That element of it certainly might help. But Galen and other people prescribe it for a whole range of quite contradictory conditions in a way that suggests that they don't really have any idea what it... You know, there are a couple of things it might have been helpful for, but the range of things it's prescribed for suggests that it's theoretical rather than a practical understanding of what it could really do. But it certainly did turn up as a medicine. I also saw one tantalizing reference in one work I was looking at to its use in cosmetics.
Ooh.
But I couldn't find anything more on that, and they didn't elaborate. And it annoyed me because that nexus of food, medicine, and cosmetics is a really interesting nexus that's really strongly overlapping in the ancient world and in the medieval world and has been for a long time. So I would have liked to know what it was referring to, but I couldn't find any more details on that. So if anyone has any idea, but I cannot think offhand of what you would use garum for in a cosmetic sense. Except maybe as like a skin treatment or something like that, because they'll use anything. They tried everything as a skin treatment. So maybe for that. So that's what I have to say about garum. One of the works I read, and I'll link this in the notes, was In Defense of Garum. It was an article. That was the title of the article from 1983. And the reason for that is it's quite clear that for a long time for classicists, garum stood as this bizarre thing that the Romans ate that was just beyond the pale as something you could possibly imagine wanting to eat. And wasn't this one of their weird barbaric traits? And there are a few Roman references by contemporary Romans to the stinking putrid fish and to this awful stuff, which were then picked up on as being like, wasn't it a horrible thing? And it must have been just disgusting. But those very same Romans who say that also in other places talk about how wonderful it is and how noble it is. So, you know, it's used like anything else that sort of typifies a culture as both attack and praise. Right. Depending on if they want to attack somebody, they'll talk about it stinking fish. And if they want to praise somebody, they'll talk about them having the highest refined tastes. Right. So it was cherry picking. And then you get in the sort of 70s and 80s and 90s, a bunch of classicists saying, hey, but it's just like Nguoc Nam or, you know, Vietnamese and Thai fish sauce, as Western European and North American cuisines were being opened up to these other cuisines. Suddenly you have a bunch of classicists are like, wait a minute, it's not so bad. Actually, it's really quite tasty. And wait, it's just like Worcester sauce and things like that. So you see this development in their own cultural prejudices that's mapped onto the ancient world. And there's this real shift in the way that it's talked about by the scholars that reflects their own, the changes in Western cuisine, not anything to do with the Romans. I just thought I'd bring that up because it amused me to see that trajectory of, you know, this very British centric,
right,
you know, insular, literally, viewpoint. And you can see that changing as you look at the different articles about Garam.
So by now you may be wondering, well, how do we get from these various ancient traditions of fermented fish to tomato ketchup that we have on our hot dogs and hamburgers? Mm-hmm. And so there's a long and twisty history here. The word ketchup comes, and presumably the sauce itself, comes from China. So there does not seem to be a continuous tradition of fish sauce in Europe from the ancient world to...
Mm-hmm. It seems to have mostly disappeared.
So
there's a couple of, there's one Italian region, I think maybe Sardinia, ironically perhaps, but maybe not. And there's at least one region of Italy which continues a fish sauce tradition. So that, but you know how regional Italian food is.
Right.
It can be very different from place to place. So there's been, I think there were a couple of holdovers, but they didn't make it into more mainstream.
Right.
And I mean, anchovy sauce and anchovies obviously do hold on, and salted anchovies. So
there was a particular cuisine in Southeast Asia, parts of Southeast Asia that eventually became settled by the Chinese. But at the time, these were the people more closely associated with the Vietnamese and the Thai and so forth that were invaded or moved into by the Chinese. They sort of inherited the food traditions of that region when they did. But they had this tradition of preserving fish. It was this kind of layering idea. You layer fish with salt and cooked rice and bamboo leaves.
Oh, okay. Which then would lead to fermentation
would
again.
Would lead to fermentation, and that would be your fish sauce. But the word ketchup is itself Chinese. So the word chop in Chinese, specifically in Hokkien Chinese, in the sort of coastal Fujian region, this the particular language spoken in the coastal region in southern China, means sauce.
Right.
And
okay.
And ke means preserved fish. So literally it means sort of preserved fish sauce or brine, fish brine sauce or something like that.
Right.
Eventually the word ketchup, it gets picked up in a number of other Asian cultures. Asian languages borrow the word ketchup, and it comes to refer to just mean sauce. So in some languages, it just means soy sauce or sweetened soy sauce. So for instance, in Indonesian, the famous ketchup manis.
Oh yeah, yeah, which we've used.
Yeah. It refers to a kind of sweet soy sauce, so not a fish sauce. So it becomes what we call semantic bleaching. It refers to sauce generally.
Right.
But of course, this is, you know, around when Europeans were trading with China. In particular, the sailors seem to have picked up the sauce to liven up their rather bland and horrible ship rations.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Which would no doubt involve
ship's biscuits, dried beef, and salt cod and things like that,
salted fish and so forth. And so having something tasty to put on it could be a boon. And so it seems to be these sailors who were in the East India Company, they brought it back to Europe in around the sort of late 17th, early 18th century.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when it makes its way to Europe. And it becomes a very profitable trade item for the East India Company.
Still in its fish sauce?
Still in its original. So they're just bringing back bottled fish sauce from China.
East, yeah.
And eventually what happens, of course, as with many things, is the Europeans try to replicate this, right? So as not to spend the massive amounts of money that is required to ship
it
back.
Right.
And this is a little bit like in the video that we did on Japanning, right?
Right, yes.
The Japanese lacquer work. So they tried to...
They liked it, but liked it was expensive, and so they tried to make knockoff
recipe,
versions.
A knockoff version of it. And so they used all kinds of other ingredients. Mushrooms were particularly important in some of the early European ketchups.
Which makes perfect sense, because it's got that kind of meaty flavor to it. Yeah,
and walnuts. Mm-hmm. Apparently it was Jane Austen.
That's walnut sauce.
Walnut. Walnut ketchup. So, and eventually tomatoes.
Because of course they weren't really a prevalent item until.
No, because tomatoes, of course, are a New World product. So this is a sort of testament to the kind of global trade that's going on here. I mean, we get a sauce that originally comes from Asia to Europe and then gets recreated using American
New World ingredients.
And so it's this sort of kind of fusion of different cultures coming together.
Fusion cuisine.
Fusion cuisine, the original fusion cuisine, if you will. Now, since we're on the topic of the U.S., the Americas, in the American colonies and later the United States, the spelling catsup, C-A-T-S-U-P, was initially the preferred American spelling, whereas ketchup with a K was the sort of more common British spelling, until the Heinz company, the Heinz brand ketchup in the U.S., they started spelling it with the K spelling as a way of differentiating themselves in the U.S. market, you know.
Right.
They all make catsup, but we make ketchup,
right,
sort of thing. And then because they sort of stole the market and became the brand, all the other producers sort of followed suit and started using that spelling. So now catsup is a sort of minor
regional
spelling.
Right? There's still regions where they say
regions,
catsup, I think. Yeah.
But it's now no longer the sort of preferred standard American spelling. But all of this, in any case, as I say, highlights the kind of globalism of this food trade. And as a result of this production of ketchup from China originally, before they were trying to reproduce it, China became kind of an economic superpower. Not just because of ketchup, I should say, but because of a number of other manufactured products. So they were, in terms of manufacturing, they were, you know, hundreds of years ahead of Europe until the Industrial Revolution.
Right.
So ketchup was one of these manufactured products that China was exporting.
That Europe didn't have an equivalent for.
That Europe didn't have and were desperate to get. Others, of course, include China and silk. China, I should say, porcelain, to make that clear. Porcelain, silk, and so forth, all these manufactured products that they were shipping out. So they became this kind of economic powerhouse because all this money was flowing into China for all these manufactured products flowing out. And it's been argued that this is one of the things that led to European global expansion, particularly in the Americas, is this the need to get
something to fix the trade imbalance.
In particular, they needed silver to pay for all these trade goods that they were getting from China.
Because they really didn't have much that the Chinese wanted.
This is the thing.
I mean, what could they export to them that China didn't already have? They had resources already in general, and then they had the production. What did Europe have that China needed other than guns, basically? And once they sort of figured out how to make those, they could make them themselves. They didn't need to import them. But silver is a scarce commodity.
Yeah. So the South American silver that the Spanish...
Was so important for that reason.
Was so important
And just went straight, a lot of it, straight to China.
Straight to China to get those
manufactured goods.
And so it has been argued that European expansionism is a direct result of this desire for...
So basically the fact that China was so advanced in its technology is the cause of the global empires. It's all China's fault? That seems fairly unfair.
I don't think that's entirely fair to put it that way, but
especially given how China then got treated later on. But I mean that also is part of the reason why England wanted to hook them on opium, right?
Right.
Because they desperately needed something to sell to the Chinese.
To the Chinese, yeah.
To make up for the amount that they were buying from them. And so they were like, hey, here's this thing we have that you're going to really want if we can get you hooked on it.
Yeah.
And so that is a direct result, really, of that as well.
Yeah. And so, you know, in terms of this kind of, and this is something that we will be discussing in a future video, but there is this kind of Columbian exchange that goes on as a result of Europeans going to the Americas. They pick up not only the silver, but also New World plants, foodstuffs, like the potato or the sweet potato in particular, goes to China and becomes an important food source in China.
Right.
So generally we can say that ketchup is this kind of really emblematic product. It's emblematic of
particular historical circumstances.
Historical circumstances. So the need for preservation, the processed foods, and the global food economy, the global food trade, as foods get shipped around the world and exchanged from one region to another.
Now, one thing you haven't addressed, but maybe is a whole other topic in itself, why does it become so quintessentially American? You know, it's not that ketchup isn't known elsewhere, but it becomes the American sauce.
Yeah.
As opposed to, for instance, in Britain, you end up with other versions, presumably basically Worcester sauce and or Worcester sauce or however we're going to pronounce that, and HP sauce are also essentially versions of ketchup. You know, other attempts to replicate this kind of a condiment, though they also have their medieval resonances, especially HP sauce because of its strong cloves and and those sweet spices that are very much a holdover of medieval traditions. So, but it would be, you know, why did Britain go that direction and the Americas end up, because Canada too, absolutely eats ketchup for sure. And we also have HP sauce here, but ketchup is definitely more prominent. And so, you know, why that split? I don't have an answer to that. And I think, that's a whole, another story. Probably more of a 20th century story, I would suspect, 19th, 20th century story.
I think one of the things that they found is sort of adding more sugar and vinegar and to make it this sort of sweet and sour kind of flavor to it.
Beyond the fish sauce.
So
instead of being sort of a meaty, because what the fish sauce, the fermentation process does is it brings out what we would now call an umami flavor. It brings out that meaty flavor of the fish. It reduces the fishiness of it quite a lot, but it produces this meatiness. So it transforms from a meaty and salty to a salty still, but sweet and sour sauce. Both in HP sauce and in
ketchup.
Not in Worcester sauce so much, but then Worcester sauce is not used the same way ketchup and HP sauce are. I think there's probably a whole second, third, fourth, I'm not saying we'll do this anytime soon if we do at all, but episode to be done on the sort of 19th and 20th century history of these sauces and condiments, because I think there's a whole story there to do with factory production and commercialization and branding and, you know, the Heinz story is probably a large part of the story of ketchup in the U.S.,
And of course, there's a whole other story about spice trade and
which and we've touched on before and is its own. As we said with the East India Company last time, that could be its own podcast, like series, spice trade. It's a very complex story.
But even in specifically the kind of Roman world and their particular spices that...
and that they were using and transporting and that became the luxury items. Yeah, for sure. But maybe let's stop now. We've talked enough about sauce for one night. And we didn't even get into all the puns. Clearly weren't sauced enough. So let's call an end to it, to the condiments for the night. But I would be interested in hearing if there's anybody who'd like to let us know of particular things we didn't cover that you'd think might be an interesting topic, or as Mark asked at the beginning, if you know about Caesars and how you pronounce Worcester sauce, Worcestershire sauce.
Worcestershire sauce. That's what I'm going with, and I'm
sticking to it. So let us know whether you're a brown sauce or a ketchup person. So let us know what your saucy thoughts are. And we'll return soon with possibly more food-related thoughts.
Yeah, we'll see.
In the next little while. Good night.
Good night.
For more information on this podcast, check out the website www.alliterative.net, where you can find links to the videos, blog posts, sources, and credits. We've also got all the ways you can follow us: Twitter, Facebook, Tumblr, G+, a mailing list, and Instagram. And please check out our Patreon, where you can pledge to support this show and our video project.
You can go directly to the videos at youtube.com/alliterative. Our email is on the website, but the easiest way to get in touch with us is on Twitter. I'm at Avensarah, AVENSARAH.
And I'm at Alliterative.
To keep up with the podcast, subscribe on iTunes or to the feed on the website. And please review it on iTunes if you can and if you've enjoyed it. It helps us a lot. We'll be back soon with more musings about the connections around us. Thanks for listening.
Bye.